but also just from a pedagogical standpoint, these are quite nice systems because the kinds of curved space-time metrics that we get in analog gravity are often quite a lot simpler than their gravitational counterparts. So one of the things that I want to spend some time focusing on today is a rotating black hole solution that arises in a particular analog system, which is way simpler than the Kerr metric. And then by having a look at that, you can see the kind of effects that go on around rotating black holes. So first thing to get across is that analogs capture this idea of having a curved space-time. Well, the thing that's perceiving this curved space-time is the waves in the system. So just to start with a bit of a broader motivation, often what we're interested in is looking at how particles and fields perceive curved space-time backgrounds. And particles are interesting because, for example, if we want to know how stars move around black holes, these astronomical bodies, if they're much smaller than the length scale of curvature, we can treat them as particles, so e.g. stars. And to investigate their orbits, we can just consider geodesics. And then we're also interested in looking at fields. So of course, if we want to know how light moves around a black hole, then light's the electromagnetic field. We need to know how that works around curved space-times. But also, gravitational waves are just oscillations of the gravitational field itself. Now, Ruth did some perturbation theory in the last lecture, and hopefully what you saw there is just how complicated it is to write down a wave equation for these gravitational waves. I think Ruth mentioned that in order to do the calculation property, there's pages and pages that you need to go through, and it becomes quite a lot to look at for the first time if you're just trying to get an understanding of how these rotating black holes affect their environments. So usually a nice thing to do when you're first coming to a problem is to ask, what's the simplest thing that I could consider? And the simplest kind of field that you can consider is just a scalar field. So the action for this would just be, this is minimally coupled to gravity. So we've just got the usual Einstein-Hilbert action. And then here we're going to think about a massless scalar field. So this is just given by, its action is just given by the kinetic term. So this phi here is our massless scalar. So we follow the usual rules of the game. We vary the action and we set variations to zero when we independently vary the metric and then our massless scalar. So when we vary the gravitational field, we of course get the Einstein equation, or Einstein equations. Well, because in this simplified system, the only thing that we have in our space-time is a scalar field. This energy momentum tensor is just going to be determined by the field. So then we also have to vary the scalar. And then we get the following equation. So this is known as the Klein-Gordon equation. Or just KG usually, you might see it written as. And this is specifically for a massless field. So what's nice about this equation is, although it's hugely simplified compared to, say, gravitational waves or the electromagnetic field, lots of the effects that occur within this equation will also occur within the wave equation for gravitational waves. So if we're just trying to build up an understanding of what happens around a rotating black hole, this is a really good example to start with because lots of the effects are going to translate over. So hopefully what I've done there is motivate that this is an interesting thing to study. And what I now want to do is take a step back from gravity and show you how this equation arises in a completely different context, and a context that hopefully you're all quite familiar with, because this is actually the kind of thing that you observe in your kitchen sink at home. So we're now looking at analog systems. Okay, so the kind of thing that I want you to visualize is that we've got some big tank, and we're going to fill this tank up to some height with water. I'm going to fill it up to some height, H naught. And we're now interested in asking how surface waves move in this system. Surface waves are ripples on the surface of the water, and we can call these delta H. And furthermore, we're going to say that we can impart some current into the water in this tank. So this is going to move the water around with some velocity field V. And usually when people start doing fluid mechanics, a nice simplifying assumption to start with is that this velocity field is irrotational, which means that its curl vanishes. And in this case, there's a nice vector identity which says the curl of the gradient of a scalar is zero. So that means that we can write this velocity field as the gradient of some scalar, which we call the velocity potential. Okay, so now let's say that these fluctuations that we've got in our system are going to have some characteristic wavelength of lambda. And another nice simplifying assumption that we can make is to say that lambda is much longer or much larger than h. So this is saying that the height of the fluid that we have in our system is quite shallow compared to the wavelengths that are moving through it. So this is known as the shallow water approximation. And if we apply these approximations, the full equations of motion that govern a classical fluid are just the Navier-Stokes equations. But if we apply these assumptions, then we can boil down those Navier-Stokes equations to two much simpler equations called the shallow water equations. So the first one is just a continuity equation for this height field. And the second one is called the Bernoulli equation, and that governs the dynamics of velocity potential. But this is equal to a constant. And another thing that we can assume here is that if we've got a tank of water where the bed of the tank is flat, then there's going to be no vertical component to this velocity field. So this is going to be two-dimensional. In other words, it only has x and y components. Okay, but now what we're interested in asking is, what are surface waves doing in this system? So in order to ask that, we need to perturb our fluid variables, which are, we've got the velocity potential, which we're going to send to some background value, or some small value. So this is our perturbation, and H is going to H naught plus delta H.
Sorry, what? Divergence of V naught is zero because there is no vortex anything.
You mean the curl?
Yeah. Sorry. What did I say?
Divergence. Curl. Yeah. So this is just it's a reasonable assumption that people make at the outset, and it boils down the complicated Navier-Stokes to a simpler set of equations. At the end, it's something that you should go back and check for consistency, but it turns out to just be a reasonable assumption.
But the physical meaning of that is that you don't have a vortex in your.
So no, it's still, we're going to see, stealing my punchline. So in a few moments, in a few minutes, we're going to see that there is a vortex solution, but you're constraining the behavior of that vortex. So you're basically constraining the radial fall off of the velocity field.
Okay.
It's a bit of a confusing thing because you're saying it's irrotational, but there is a way that that vortex can, we'll see in a moment when we go ahead and solve that equation. Okay, so perturbing our background variables, we just go ahead, apply the rules of linear perturbation theory. And when we perturb the continuity equation, we can package the linearized version as this. And the Bernoulli equation gives this. And if I didn't say it already, this g here that's appearing in the Bernoulli equation, this is the gravitational acceleration here on Earth where we're doing our tabletop experiment. So we usually take this to be approximately 9.81 meters per second squared. And in this linear equation that we've written down here, this this divergence term, it's just a neat way of packaging this. We're understanding this divergence to act on everything to its right. So if we were really to expand that out, then it would be the divergence of V naught multiplying delta H. So we have two equations for two variables. We've got the height perturbations and the velocity potential perturbations. So we're going to combine those into a single equation for phi. So we've now got a nice wave equation that we can go ahead and solve for our phi field. And then once we solve for phi, if we're interested in what the surface waves are doing, then we can go back to this equation and we can ask what delta H is doing once we know what phi is. So at this point, you might wonder, okay, so why all this prattling on about fluids? What does this have to do with gravity? If you haven't guessed yet, the punchline here is that this equation that we've written down that governs surface waves is completely mathematically equivalent to this Klein-Gordon equation that we wrote down for our massless scalar field in a curved space-time. And in order to make this identification, we need to write down what the effective metric that these surface waves are seeing is. And it turns out that if we go through a calculation, then we can package this metric as the following. I'll define these terms in a moment. So here we define this this C parameter, which is given by root GH naught. And this determines the local speed propagation of surface waves in a shallow fluid. Okay, so we've now got this effective metric, but why is it interesting? Well, it turns out that this effective metric can have some curvature if the background fluid variables vary from point to point in our system. Question? So the way to do it would be to write this out in index notation. You could then go back to your Klein-Gordon equation, expand out the components, and then you identify components and you identify the metric. The trick really is to, there's a little subtlety in the calculation which involves this root minus, okay, hang on, there's another point that I should have mentioned at the beginning. Root normally works in the plus minus 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 convention, right? So my metric here, hopefully you guys have seen this before, but just to flag it at this point, this is a minus plus plus plus. My metric over here is gonna be, because it's one dimensional lower, this is gonna be a minus plus plus metric. And that's why there's this minus in the under that square root there. And so I was saying that there's a subtlety when you're picking off those components. You need to be careful that you get the right determinant when you write this down, which is where that prefactor in front of the metric comes in. And so we're going to get this metric's going to have some curvature if the background fluid variables are varying from point to point in our system. So if V naught is a function of our coordinates, and we could also imagine that we've got some spatially varying height field as well in full generality, this is going to give us some curvature. Okay, so now we have this this mapping between surface waves and the fluctuations of a scalar field on some curved space-time, but what kind of curved space-times can we simulate? So the one that I want to spend most time today thinking about is a system called a draining vortex. And this is exactly the kind of phenomenon that you would observe in, for example, your kitchen sink or your bath, if you like to take baths, when you pull the plug out. When you pull the plug, all the water is going to rush towards the plug hole, and it's going to start draining down, and it's going to start spiraling, which gives you this whirlpool-like phenomenon that occurs over the plug hole. So to visualize this, we're working in theory here, so we can assume that we've got a nice big infinite tank of water in experiments. This is difficult to implement in practice because we don't have an infinite amount of money. But just for theoretical considerations at the moment, assume that we've got some water tank which extends to infinity. And the principal reason for doing that is so that we don't have to consider how these surface waves are reflecting off the boundary. So in the center of our infinite water tank, we're going to put a plug hole. And then water is going to drain out of this system, which is going to cause this whirlpool kind of phenomenon to occur over the plug hole. And if this is a nice circularly symmetric hole in the bottom of the tank, then we can work in polar coordinates. So here I'm going to call theta my angular coordinate, which goes from 0 to 2 pi here, in contrast to three-dimensional space, where theta is usually the polar angle, which only goes from 0 to pi. Principally, I've written this so I don't have to write phi here, which then might confuse things with the scalar field. So in this coordinate system, we can write this velocity field as containing a radial component, which we'll call vr, and then an angular component, v theta. So that v naught is can be decomposed in this way. And now what we want to do is get some expressions for what our velocity field is doing. So in order to do that, we can appeal to our shallow water equations, and we can try solve for this velocity field. And first of all, if we really do have an infinite amount of water, then as water is draining from this system, we're still going to have an infinite amount afterwards. So we can assume that we've got a stationary setup. So we can neglect time derivatives in that background equation. And another nice simplification we can make is we can say, initially, we're going to constrain our interest to this region of the flow out here, where this water height is approximately constant. So in this region, h naught is roughly a constant. And what that means in practice is that when we look at our continuity equation up there, if h naught is a constant, this just means that the divergence of v is equal to zero, which was nicely foreshadowed by my friend at the front here. So the next condition is that in this whole derivation, we assumed also that the velocity field was curl-free. So this is going to give us a second condition. And the eagle-eyed amongst you may now say, OK, well, what about the Bernoulli equation that we had? There's an extra condition that we have there. We appear to have an overdetermined system. But basically, the point here is that if we solve these equations, then we get some approximate profile. And then we can use the third equation to give us a validity constraint on when this approximation is actually valid. So if we go ahead and solve these, we find that V naught is when we can solve the divergence bit for the radial part of the velocity profile, which ends up being proportional to 1 over r. And the angular part is also proportional to 1 over r. And here I've introduced these two constants, which we're going to say are positive constants, that d and c are positive. This d here is the draining parameter, and c is the circulation. So here we've got this minus sign in front of our radial component here because we're thinking about a draining fluid. So there should be an influx of water towards the center of the system. And C could either be positive or negative, depending on which way our vortex is rotating. But Without loss of generality, we can set this to be positive, so that our vortex is rotating in the positive theta direction. And this goes back to your point before about how can we have a vortex in the system? Well, we can have a rotating fluid flow, but if we're working in two dimensions, this is the unique solution that we can have for a rotating fluid flow. Okay, so now we have a height field and we have a velocity field. So what we can do is we can plug that into our effective metric up there, and we can find out what the metric looks like. So the first thing to notice is that because we've assumed that this the water height is constant, this is going to mean quite nicely that the speed of our surface wave is going to be constant throughout the region that we're considering. And that means that this this prefactor in front of the metric is just going to be a constant. So we can drop that because it's not going to play a role in our equations of motion. And if we now write out the line element for our vortex, then what we get is that's it. Well, here I'm working in some units, like we usually do in GR, where we can set the speed of propagation to 1. So this is saying little c is 1. In some of the later expressions, I'll restore this little c just so you can see how it plays a role in the relevant quantities in the system.
Sorry, did you just get that equation by kind of plugging in this V naught solution to that G mu nu?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Okay, aren't we ignoring dt though? Are we not?
Dt's here?
Partials with respect to t, but we're not ignoring dt. Like, we're not setting that to a constant.
You mean in this effective metric up here?
Yeah.
So what do you mean by the partials?
Well, you said since it's essentially an infinite system, you said, you know, we can maybe ignore the time derivatives, which I think is how we get that the divergence of V naught.
Yeah, so this is just saying that these metric functions don't depend on time.
Okay.
And they don't depend on the angle either, because we assumed that we have this nice symmetric hole in the middle, mm-hmm. so that our velocity field is only depending on the radial coordinate. So the only thing appearing in our metric coordinates is is the radial coordinate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so we have some metric, and how do we know this corresponds to an effective black hole? Well, in actual fact, this is similar to a coordinate system that arises for describing Schwarzschild, I think Kerr black holes as well. You can certainly do it for Schwarzschild. So it's called the Pan-Levy-Gullstrand coordinate system. Sometimes Gullstrand-Pan-Levy, depending on who you like to think got there first. And but this isn't the coordinate system that we usually first write down when we're thinking about what a black hole looks like. So how can we get to such an expression for our metric? Well, we can recall that where this is coming from is this Klein-Gordon equation. And this Klein-Gordon equation is invariant under a coordinate transformation. So with our surface wave metric, we can also do a coordinate transformation, and we can try get something that we're more familiar with. Okay, let's see if I can remember what this coordinate transformation is. Okay. So we're going to transform the time coordinate to some new t prime. Oh, here I'll put little c, the wave speed, back in just so you can see that it's next to this velocity, radial velocity squared. And then we're also transforming the angular coordinate. But here, the VR and V theta are just the ones that we've written down in our velocity field. And when we do this, what we now get is, in our new coordinate system, there we go. Well, we've defined this f function, which is just 1 minus d squared on r squared. Okay, so now we can start seeing that there's some similarities between this draining vortex metric and this Kerr metric that we've gotten written down over here. So in order to make those similarities apparent, the first thing that we need to do is identify the main difference, which is that this is a 2 plus 1 dimensional metric, 2 dimensions in space, because our surface waves are living on an effective 2 dimensional surface, whereas in the case of the Kerr black hole, we have 3 dimensions of space. So the first thing that we need to do is restrict our attention to some plane around the Kerr black hole, and the one that's usually nicest to think about is the equatorial plane. Going back to Kerr for a moment. The equatorial plane is just theta equals pi on 2. And if we look in this plane, then we can write down the metric in this plane. The first thing to notice is that this, if theta equals pi on 2, and sine squared theta is just going to be 1. Yeah. So this is going to make some of our metric functions simpler. Or equatorial. And then there's no variation in theta if we're restricting our attention to the equatorial plane. So we can now start making drawing some similarities. So one of the annoying little things about this identification is that in the Kerr metric we've got these r squared plus a squared floating around, whereas in our draining vortex metric we just have r squareds. This is a small subtlety, but it's not too important. The first thing that you your attention might be drawn to is the presence of this cross term here. So this is one similarity. And then the next main similarity is that in preceding the dt squared pieces in both metrics, we've got this function here, which is going to go to zero on the horizon. And that same function is appearing in front of the dr squared piece. But instead, it's the inverse, which is going to make that piece diverge when that term goes to zero. So when that term goes to zero, that's going to give us the horizon of our system, which means that we can write down the first really important feature that this metric has to have if we're to identify it with a black hole. And when f goes to zero, the location at which this happens is, and I'm now going to put little c back in, so in full physical units. And this is our analog horizon. This is the first main, really important feature of our metric. So the next one is that it's something that is specific to, well, it's something that a Kerr black hole has, which a Schwarzschild black hole doesn't. And this feature that I'm about to speak about is going to play a role in something that we come to talk about at the end of the lecture. And in order to understand what this feature is telling us about, it's useful to consider a particular set of observers, static observers. And these are observers that in this coordinate system that we have are going to be sitting at a fixed radial location and a fixed angular location. So they're just going to be moving in time. So in that case, the tangent to their world lines is just going to be d by dt. And we can see that something funny is going to happen if we ask what the norm of this vector is. So appealing to our effective metric, write down the norm of this, and we find that it's given by the following expression. Now, recalling that I'm working in a mostly pluses convention and minus for the time direction, if this has a negative norm, then that means it's going to be a time-like vector, and if it's positive, then it's going to be space-like. So we can see that when r is going to infinity, so far away from the center of our vortex, this vector is going to be time-like. But there's going to be some critical radius, and when we cross this radius, the norm of this vector is going to flip, and it's going to become space-like. And what that means is that, so if we write down what this critical radius is, we can solve when this goes to zero to find that this radius, which is called where again, little c wave speed is on the bottom. This is called the static limit. And what this means is that for someone who's inside of RE, they will not be able to remain static relative to someone who is static at infinity. So the interpretation here is that someone inside of RE is going to be swept around by the rotation of the black hole. And we can see that because this vector here is becoming space-like. What that's saying is that in order to stay static with respect to someone outside, they need to travel on a space-like trajectory, which they're not allowed to do.
When we talk about massless scalar fields in space-time, they travel at the speed of light. This velocity v is certainly very less in experiments compared to speed of light. And my question is regarding if it's not the speed of light, then what does this horizon mean physically in terms of?
Okay. Yeah. Good. So the relevant speed in this effective metric is the wave speed, which is quite a lot lower than the speed of light. It's just determined by the square root of the water height, so you can tune your wave speed depending on how high the fluid is. So it's the wave speed because this is the constant speed that long wavelength fluctuations are propagating at. And I'm actually just going to come to that point, so if you just let me just go ahead with this, and then hopefully this will become clear. So yeah, we can now build up a picture of the relevant, of the important locations in our system. So, of course, in the middle we've got our plug hole. We've then got our horizon, which is some location around it. We've got our static limit, RE. And you might be wondering what that E means. Well, that's because this is the boundary of a region which is called the ergosphere. And the ergosphere is this region between RE and RH, where our fluctuations are, or our waves, our scalar is dragged around with the rotation of the background metric. So coming back to your point now, what this analogy is quite a nice pedagogical tool here, because it gives us some nice interpretation for what horizon means in this system. So if we go to our expressions for this horizon and also the ergosphere, and we reframe that in terms of the wave speed and the background velocity field, we find that that horizon occurs at a location where the magnitude of the velocity field, so at this location, the magnitude of the velocity field is equal to the wave speed. This gives us our horizon. And what this is saying is that because our long wavelength fluctuations propagate at this fixed speed c, whenever the velocity field exceeds c, the fluctuations are just going to be dragged down the throat of the vortex. The relevant thing is that there's some upper limit to how fast these waves can propagate. And if the background velocity exceeds that, then the fluctuations are going to be dragged along by the velocity field. So here c is playing the role of the limiting speed in the same way that the speed of light plays a role in GR. And similarly for the ergosphere, we identify this as the location where the total magnitude of the whole velocity field is equal to the wave speed. And because our system is rotating, what this is meaning is that in this region approaching the vortex, the velocity field is going to be spinning so fast that waves won't be able to travel fast enough to go against the rotation of our system. Okay, so in the last 20 minutes, let's say, now I want to show you how we can use this analog formalism to look at an effect which is very important for real gravitational black holes, and this is known as superradiance. And it's an important effect because it allows rotating black holes to get rid of their angular momentum. So superradiance is related to something that you might have heard of called the Penrose effect, which is basically superradiance but for particles. And this effect is going to allow us to mine energy from our black hole and gradually gradually spin it down. So the way that we're going to look at this is we're going to take our Klein-Gordon equation up at the top, and we're going to go ahead and try solve it. So the first thing to notice here is that because the coefficients of our metric only depend on the radial coordinate, we've got a nice amount of symmetry there. So we can do a Fourier decomposition of our scalar field. We can decompose this into the different frequency and azimuthal components. Where this is the frequency. And this m, the azimuthal number, should be familiar from decompositions when you're looking at solving the Schrodinger equation, for example, in quantum mechanics. And this is basically saying that it's basically counting the number of times that your wave oscillates as you trace a path around the origin of the coordinate system. So m has got to be some positive or negative integer. But the nice thing here is that because g mu nu, or its components, are just functions of r, when we do this decomposition, there's no time dependence or theta dependence in our metric that's going to couple these components together. So we can solve for, these should be radial functions here. We can now insert this ansatz into our Klein-Gordon equation and write down an effective one-dimensional equation in the radial direction for this r omega m. So if we go ahead, do that plugging in the ansatz and separating out the different modes, what we get is the following simplified one-dimensional equation. Now, building on what Ruth said last time, when we try solve these equations, a lot of our intuition is built from just regular quantum mechanics, where we're used to seeing this equation in the form of some second order derivative acting on the field plus some potential multiplying the field is equal to zero. So it'd be really nice if we could get this equation into that simplified form so that we can just start using our intuition that we've got from quantum mechanics. So in order to do this, first of all, what we can do is perform another coordinate transformation and transform to what's called the tortoise coordinate. Klein-Gordon equation at the top. This one. So it's just a case of plugging in the components of the metric, plugging in that ansatz, working through everything, and putting it in that form.
So this is not related at all to what you were doing with the analog?
Nope, this is. So in the analog, we've got the wave equation. That wave equation is equivalent to the Klein-Gordon equation over there, provided we use that metric. So now, we're essentially taking that equation, but in the Klein-Gordon form, plugging in the components of the metric and just getting... So really, you could think about just starting from that wave equation and going directly to this. It's just we package things in a way that has got things that we've identified from the metric, like this, this F here. I suppose one thing I should say is... No, that's right, yeah.
So what my question is, so this is effective solving that equation there, the Klein-Gordon equation. Is it, so it's not related at all to the analog? I know you can use that because that's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But is the analog useful for this picture, or is that just another subject that is kind of decoupled from this thing?
No, I mean, so this is an effect that occurs in the analog.
Oh.
And it will also occur around a real black hole. I'm just going through it here because the equations of the analog are simpler and it's a bit easier to write out within 10 minutes. Okay. Well, everything that I'm about to say, the equations end up being more complicated, but you get the same effect that I'm about to go through with a real Kerr black hole as well. So this tortoise coordinate R star is defined from this expression. And when we solve this, we get that the tortoise coordinate here, this is the natural log and what this tortoise coordinate is doing is it's stretching out our radial range, which goes from the horizon to spatial infinity onto the whole real line. This tortoise coordinate is now going to go from minus infinity to plus infinity, where minus infinity is where the horizon is, and plus infinity is just spatial infinity. So when we make this transformation, what we can see is that this R star is going to take... Hang on. Sorry, that should have been another radial derivative there, because this should be a second order differential equation in radial derivative. So what this R star is going to do is it's going to take care of this combination F multiplying D by DR. But then we've still got this this annoying factor under this outside derivative, this factor of R here, which is going to give us a first order derivative in our equation. And ideally, we want to get rid of that if we're going to apply our usual quantum mechanics way of solving these kinds of equations. So the way that we can sort that out is to redefine the radial part of our field, some new radial field psi, so I don't keep having to write out the indices. I'm just going to say that that's a function of omega and m. And the trick here is to put a square root of r on the bottom. And this is going to sort out this this r here. So now what we get when we put these this new coordinate and this this transformation here into that wave equation, we get something that looks a lot nicer, which is some second derivative and some potential, where the potential that we get depends on the frequency and the azimuthal number as well as the velocity field. And that's what we get. So the usual approach to solving these problems is to ask, what is our potential doing? And how is this this psi field interacting with it? So in order to do that, it's useful to sketch what this potential looks like. And for a large range of parameters, what you would see is that this potential basically, with R star on the bottom, looks something like this. So it's got some peak in the middle, and then on both sides, it's asymptoting to some constant values. And at spatial infinity, it's going to go to minus omega squared. And at negative infinity, approaching the horizon, it's going to go to something we'll call minus omega tilde squared, where omega tilde we're defining as this combination here. And a useful way of packaging this is to recognize that this c on r h squared is the rotational velocity of the velocity field on the, this horizon. So what this omega tilde here is, it's the frequency in a frame which is rotating with the horizon. And the approach now is to ask, well, first of all, okay, so what is it that we're interested in? We're interested in asking what happens when we start somewhere outside the black hole and we send a wave towards it. This wave's going to interact with that potential, it's going to scatter off it, and what comes back at us, what is reflected? So this is the question that we want to answer. So the physical picture that we have here is we're sending in some wave, which we'll say has an amplitude A out. Obviously not A in. A out is what comes out. And then after this is interacted, there's going to be some transmitted wave through the horizon, which we'll call AH. And normally what you would like to do in quantum mechanics, whenever it is that you guys take it, usually you're presented with some simplified potential, which is usually some step function you can solve exactly you can get some analytic solutions and you can just relate the different amplitudes to each other through these exact solutions. This is a bit more complicated, and to make matters worse, this V of R is actually implicitly a function of R star, which is the what derivative we have here. So through this one-to-one mapping here, R is really just R star. So this is even more complicated than it looks. So how can we go about asking how our scattering coefficients are related to each other? Well, we can look at the asymptotics of using the fact that this potential goes to some constant values. We can solve asymptotically for what psi is doing. So we can see that A out is just going to be e to the I omega R star. A in is going to be e to the minus I omega R star. And AH is going to be e to the minus I omega tilde R star. And in order to find a relation between these scattering coefficients, rather than trying to solve the wave equation exactly, what we can do is exploit some nice conserved quantities of this wave equation. So this equation has a nice conserved quantity called the Wronskian, which is defined as, and I might get a sign wrong here, but it doesn't matter too much. The following combination. And we can see that this is conserved, which means that it doesn't depend on the radius that we're looking at in our system. If it's conserved, then it should be constant, which means that when we act on it with a radial derivative, it gives zero. So we can check that this is right. We act on this with R star. Then this first term is going to give us the field multiplying a second derivative. The derivative is then going to act on this first term here. What we can see is that because the second term is minus the complex conjugate of the first, when we act on the radial with the radial derivative on this term here, those two contributions are just going to cancel. So from the second term here, all we're going to get is the other second derivative term. Now what we can do is we can plug in this equation over here, which tells us what the second derivative is in terms of the potential. So this is just going to give us V psi. This gives us V psi star. So both of these are just V mod psi squared. There's a minus between them, so this is equal to zero. Lo and behold, it's conserved. And we can now use the fact that this is conserved to relate these asymptotic amplitudes to each other. So first of all, if we evaluate this Wronskian at the horizon, then when we plug it in, we plug in our asymptotic expression, what we get is simply this. And at spatial infinity, we're going to get something similar. Because these two are equal to each other, we can start cancelling the factors of 2i. We can rearrange this so that we have a nice expression relating these coefficients. Its derivative is zero. No, there's a minus sign between them. So this term is the same as this term, but there's a minus sign.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Psi star times V
mm-hmm.
psi minus.
Yeah. Psi star V psi V psi star. So it's just the same term, just switching. Yeah. Okay. These are just radial functions. They're just functions. And V is just potential. Okay, so the last thing to say here is that normally when we're doing these scattering problems, we're interested in asking how much is reflected back at us relative to what we sent in. And to do that, we define the scattering coefficient. So the reflection coefficient is the ratio of the outgoing amplitude to the ingoing amplitude. Transmission coefficient is the ratio of the transmitted amplitude to the ingoing amplitude. And now we can write this expression relating our amplitudes to an expression relating our scattering coefficients. Just the punchline. And we can see from this that something very interesting is going to happen when this prefactor here in front of the transmission coefficient goes negative. So interesting. Because in that case, this whole term here is going to be negative. But because the sum has got to be equal to 1, what that means is that the reflection coefficient has got to be greater than 1. And a reflection coefficient greater than 1 means that what we get out of our system is bigger than what we sent in, so we get amplification. Yeah, so A, oh yeah, my bad. That's what you get when you try to do it off the dome and you don't look at your lecture notes. A, yeah. You got me. Is A plus. Sorry about that. Good spot. Thank you. It's even worse because here I've mixed A plus and A in. Terrible. Okay. So, yeah, if this prefactor here is negative, we get this amplification. So let's ask, when is this negative? So restricting our attention to the moment for the moment to positive frequencies. This prefactor is going to be negative if omega tilde is zero. And now going back to our expression over there for omega tilde, find that this is zero if the frequency is less than the azimuthal number multiplied by the rotational velocity of the system on its horizon. So this is a necessary, it's the condition which we need to satisfy in order to get this amplification. And if this is satisfied, then the kind of amplification that we get is super radiance. And what this means is that when you send your wave into the black hole, it's got some specific amplitude. Now the wave that comes back has a larger amplitude, which means the wave has grown in energy. The energy has to have come from somewhere, and where it's come from is it's stolen some rotational energy from the black hole, exited with a larger amplitude, and the black hole has slowed down in its rotation because of this. So this super radiance effect is a way to for black holes to shed their energy. And in the case of real Kerr black holes, we actually get exactly this. So remember that all of this was derived using the analog system. But the resulting expression that we get for super radiance is exactly the same in the case of Kerr. It's just that this rotational velocity here is the one relevant to Kerr black holes, which is usually given by this.
In Kerr black holes, we have super radiance, but we also have to make it
I see. Ah, I see what you mean. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So in Kerr, it's you get a naked singularity if the rotation is larger than some threat. If A is larger than M, you get a naked singularity. Could you have a naked singularity here? Yes, you could, because you could just set D equals zero, and you could just have a rotating vortex, which is a perfectly legitimate solution from the fluid mechanics perspective. And a lot of interesting things that happen there.
Say again, how do you evoke omega tilde?
Yeah, so this is just defined by, so we're defining omega tilde as the asymptotic property of this, or what this potential is asymptoting to as we go to the horizon. So we just look at what this this potential here is doing. As we go to the horizon, F goes to zero. So we just get this first term, but on the horizon, R is equal to RH, so we get that.
Okay.
So I'm out of time, but the last thing I want to say is that this has all just been the theory of it, but we've actually gone and measured this the super radiance effect in a real experiment. So this was something I did during my PhD in 2017, I think we did the experiment. Essentially what we had there was a giant bathtub of water. There was some hole in the middle. There was some water inlet over here, which supplies water, makes it spin round, and then it's going to drain in the center. And the experiment was basically we had a wave generator over on this side, which sent waves in towards the center of the vortex. And these waves then scattered with this vortex in the middle. And the point of the experiment was to take pictures of this, decompose those waves into the different omega and M modes, and see whether we got amplification, which was consistent with super radiance. And that was something that we were actually able to measure, which was the first time this super radiance had been detected in an analog experiment. But because we haven't observed it around real black holes, it was also the first time it was ever detected. So that was nice. And I think I'll stop there.